Hello and welcome. This is Nancy reading with you from the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette for Wednesday, February 8th, 2017. We'll start with our front page news. The first has to do with bank acquisitions. And the headline is First Busey Makes Bid to Expand into Burbs. To help it expand to Chicago's southwest suburbs, First Busey Corporation is buying Joliet-based First Community Financial Partners for approximately $235.8 million. The purchase comes after Busey expanded in 2016 to St. Louis with a $210.7 million purchase of Pulaski Financial. Busey hopes to complete the deal in mid-2017 and merge First Community Banks into Busey in late 2017. The deal is subject to regulatory and shareholder approval. We have decided we'd like to move into some areas that have a little more densely populated areas, First Busey President and CEO Van Dukeman said. That area, it has over 1.6 million people, and that's excluding Cook County. 600,000 households, 70,000 businesses. First Community, founded in 2004, has 9 branches in Will, DuPage, and Grundy counties, with more than $1.26 billion in assets. Once approved, Busey will have 55 branches and approximately $7 billion in assets. Dukeman expects First Community to be a good fit and praised it for having a really good group of associates. Under the deal, First Community shareholders will receive 0.396 shares of Busey common stock and $1.35 in cash for each share of First Community common stock. For current Busey customers, not much will change besides access to more branches, Dukeman said. We do have some customers up north, some in the Chicago area, he said. They will be able to avail themselves to those 9 branches. For First Community customers, the name of their bank will change and businesses will have access to more lending capacity. Busey also has a wealth management platform that will become available to First Community customers. We do believe it will be a benefit for them, Dukeman said. With 2 major expansions in the past 2 years, Dukeman doesn't think Busey will stop growing. I think there's opportunity both within the footprint we already have, as well as extensions, Dukeman said. Asked whether the long-term plan is to be bought by a larger bank, Dukeman said, "That's not our intention. I think the biggest thing here is to continue to have this company feel like a good community bank." Also on page 1, we have news from the Railside Golf Course. The headline is Fairway Will Be Farmland If Talks Falter. If a group of local investors is unable to strike a deal to buy the shuttered Railside Golf Course within a week, its owner intends to begin turning the 18-hole, 197-acre course into farmland. Guy Percy, who served as Railside's PGA golf pro from 1993 to 2004, said he and 3 other Gibson City residents formed a committee following the public golf course's closure in November to begin the process of trying to buy it from owner Doug Brooker of Sibley. The committee today has grown to include 8 people, Percy said, but not much progress on reaching a deal has been made. We've reached a bit of an impasse, Percy told members of the Gibson Area Chamber of Commerce, but I'm not going to totally give up. The property, put up for sale in September, was listed at $2.288 million by Minion Real Estate in Gibson City. Percy said his committee, contingent upon being able to raise enough funds, has put in an offer to buy the property, which, in addition to its 18 holes, includes a 5,000-square-foot clubhouse with a pro shop, restaurant, lounge, and 150-seat banquet facility. We haven't reached an agreement on the price, Percy said. If no deal ends up being reached for the entire property, Percy said his committee would likely put in an offer to buy only a portion of it, with the intention of turning that land into a 9-hole course. The funds to buy it would be raised by investors in the community, he said. If we would, by chance, reach a deal, we're going to be reaching out to people to buy in some sort of a share, Percy said, because my goal would be able to do this without any debt, just to raise the whole thing and be done with it. Demolition on tap. If no deal is reached soon, demolition of the back 80 acres of the course, the 9 holes farthest away from the clubhouse, is slated to begin next week. We'll turn the back 80 into farm ground. That's the plan, Percy said of Brooker. He's going to start tearing it up at hole 14 and move it on over. He's a farmer, so he'd be farming it. Percy said it is conceivable that a deal could still be reached to buy the rest of the course after the demolition begins. In that scenario, the remaining 9 holes could be kept for use as a public golf course. That would be a great asset for this community, Percy said. We players know that. Mayor Dan Dickey said the city might be able to provide a financial incentive to a prospective buyer. With city council approval, obviously, I think the city would be able to help out if it makes good business sense, Dickey said. Chamber of Commerce President Ryan Minion, owner of Minion Real Estate, said it is an unfortunate reality for the state's golf courses that there is really good farm ground here. That's where the value is in our land, and we all know that. Our community is built on that, Minion said. The best use for land is farming it. But we all like the golf course. We want a golf course in Gibson City. It's an amenity to the town. We all grew up playing golf there and had our kids go through there. So we use that course a lot. Ripple effect. If Railside remains closed, Percy is concerned about the spin-off effect it would have on the entire community. Every home would be devalued on Railside Drive. All those homes are going to go down $50,000 each, Percy said, referring to the subdivision abutting the course. And already a few construction projects stopped there that were going to happen. Percy said comparable homes to those on Railside Drive would also see their property values decline, regardless of where they are located in town. It would ripple through town and devalue all of the town, Percy said. Restaurants, hardware stores, and other shops would also likely see a decline in business if the course were to stay closed, Percy added, noting that many golfers who used Railside would often stop by those places after playing around. And Gibson City Melvin Sibley High School would also need to find a new place by next fall for its golf team to practice and host meets. Saybrook's Indian Springs Golf Course is not far away, but Percy said there is no guarantee the course would be available for that purpose. We'll move on to the local section. Tom Kasich's column appears today, and his headline is, "Sorry, Election Weary, Time to Vote Again." Even in Urbana, there are only so many Democratic votes to go around. And now there are 3 Democratic women running for mayor in a primary election 20 days away that traditionally attracts few voters. All of this is coming 3 months after a big presidential election that left a lot of Democrats exhausted and distraught. Folks, I think, are really realizing there's another election, said Esther Patt, the former Urbana City Council member, who is back again as chairwoman of Mayor Laurel Prussing's reelection campaign. It's hard because there's so much fatigue from the last election. The number one mission now is to let people know there's an election on February 28th. I just hope people vote, said Diane Marlin, a current council member who was challenging Prussing, as is Evelyn Burnett Underwood, the third candidate. Very few people vote in primaries, and people are really exhausted. They're worn out. But of all the elections, your local elections are the ones that have the most impact on our everyday life. 4 years ago, fewer than 2,000 Urbana Democrats voted in a two-way mayoral primary. 12 years ago, fewer than 5,000 Democrats turned out in a three-way race, much like this one, where Prussing unseated Mayor Todd Satterthwaite by 270 votes, and a third candidate, Shirley Hersey, got 125 votes. Compare those numbers with the 12,693 votes that Hillary Clinton got out of Urbana in November. The majority of people who vote in November elections do not vote in municipal elections. So that leaves the majority of voters as targets to increase turnout. I'm sure that's what the Marlin campaign is doing and what we're doing too, said Pat, who has helped run pressing election campaigns since a successful race for state representative in 1992. Pressing's had a lot of support from a lot of Democrats, and we're trying to get as many as we can to vote on February 28th or before. Early voting has started, and as of Tuesday morning, County Clerk Gordy Halton said about 210 people already had voted for mayor. Pat said her message to Democratic primary voters is that Pressing has been fearless in fighting for what she believes in, whether it's battling Carl over property tax payments or defending the Police Training Institute at the University of Illinois. Her greatest asset, and why people support her, Pat said, is that she fights for the public interest. And once she's got her position, she isn't going to waver just because people are yelling at her. She takes the beating and goes on. And then when we win in the appellate court, in the Carl property tax case, people say, oh, she was right. She doesn't make her decisions based on tomorrow's headline, but instead about what is in the best interest of Urbana for the long term. One fear in Pressing's campaign is that Marlin is reaching out to the Republicans to vote in the Democratic primary. There is no Republican primary, with only Rex Bradfield representing the GOP. Marlin has received campaign contributions from people who are more traditionally identified with Republicans. $1,000 from Peter and Kim Fox, and $2,500 from Howard Wakeland, who runs Advantage Properties CU. Asked if she is encouraging crossover voting, Marlin said, I'm not actively seeking them, no, but the fact of the matter is that this is a local election, and people vote for the person rather than the party. Pat, though, said that some Democratic voters are skeptical. I can understand the political strategy of trying to play to someone other than the Democratic base to get extra votes, but what's that going to mean after the election? That's a concern. People in my neighborhood were concerned when they saw Diane say, in a candidate forum last week, what she did about loosening development regulations. That and a $2,500 campaign contribution from someone, Wakeland, who days later announced that he has a development site in Urbana. What kind of change is this going to be? For the record, Marlin said at the forum that the city has to look at specific procedures and practices that have been used over the years to see how they're impacting business and work with the community on ways we can modify them. Marlin said Tuesday, I don't make promises to anybody. The only promise I make to anybody is the one I make to everybody, and that is I'll do the very best I can for the community. Further, that she's not advocating loosening regulations. We all follow, no matter what city you're in, the same fire codes and building standards, Marlin said. What I'm saying, and what builders have told me, is that there are ways to meet every single standard, but other cities give them flexibility in figuring out how to do that. We don't compromise safety or quality, and we don't compromise our principles. But giving people some flexibility in meeting codes, which is what other communities do, that's what they mean when they say that Urbana often makes it harder. Marlin said Urbana has to cultivate good, productive relationships with business people and developers. Being the mayor of a little bitty city like this is all about personal relationships, she said. We have many people in Urbana-Champaign who tell me they won't put one more dime in this city because of the way the city administration has not cultivated and kept a positive working relationship. The first thing I would do is bring in people who used to invest in Urbana and stopped, and people like Champaign businessman Carlos Nieto, who could very well build over here and chose not to. I'd bring in a group and say, what would make it easier for you to invest in Urbana, or what have we done to keep you out of here? And then just listen and go from there. In news from the Urbana School Board, demotion to principal met with opposition. Reassignment of deputy superintendent criticized at meeting. I think we really need to educate people that there's nothing wrong with a strong black woman. That was longtime Urbana educator Willie Somerville's comment to the school board. which was met with booming applause. Concerning news that Urbana's deputy superintendent, Dr. Jennifer Ivory Tatum, will be demoted to an elementary school principal position next year. An email from Superintendent Don Owen was sent to district staff just after 6 p.m. Tuesday, informing employees that, among other things, the current principal of Thomas Paine Elementary School would be retiring this spring, and Ivory Tatum would be replacing her. According to several Urbana employees at the board meeting and documents obtained by the News Gazette, Dr. Ivory Tatum has a proven track record as an elementary principal, and I know that her leadership will support the continued success of Thomas Paine's teachers, staff, and students, the email said. But the announcement was met with strong opposition from people across the Urbana community. At a standing room only meeting, folks such as Somerville, Urbana City Clerk Phyllis Clark, and even State Treasurer Michael Frericks showed up to oppose the demotion. 15 people, teachers, community members, administrators, and students, addressed the board opposing the change. If you take a vote to put Dr. Ivory Tatum in any position other than what she's already in, it would be the most egregious error this school board could make. Take the right vote and keep Jennifer Ivory Tatum in the position she's in. If you remove her, we will have another monoculture in administration. We don't need that, Clark said, speaking to an issue several people raised about the need for racial diversity in the school district. Ivory Tatum is the only black woman working as a head administrator in Urbana. Beth Mears, an instructional coach at Leal Elementary School, asked the board to reconsider the decision, saying Ivory Tatum's experiences are unlike anyone else's at the central office. Representation for elementary buildings is vital to meeting the needs of students and family, teachers and principals. I urge the school board tonight to consider the implications of losing an advocate like Jennifer Ivory Tatum, Mears said. In such a highly politicized time, shouldn't we be focused on unity in our district rather than dividing it? It was unclear in the email whether this would be a voluntary move for Ivory Tatum or whether the school board would have to approve the personnel change. Generally, when an administrator is moved to a lower position, the change requires a vote from the school board. The rest of the email indicated the district would make moves to hire either an internal or external candidate to replace Ivory Tatum. Owen said he would restructure the position and it will be advertised as an assistant superintendent for student learning. The new assistant superintendent will be joining Todd Taylor, assistant superintendent of student services, and Catherine Barber, assistant superintendent of human resources and professional development, next school year, as we would work together to support you and the work you do with our students and families, the email to staff said. After more than an hour of public comment, the school board moved on to other items on the agenda, which did not include a vote on any personnel item in executive session. It is not our policy to engage in conversation with speakers after public comment, Board President John Dimmitt said, just before inviting anyone interested in leaving to do so. Keep in mind this is a personnel matter, and out of respect for all parties involved, we don't comment on personnel issues. Every employee is entitled to due process. Owen did not return requests for comment on the issue. From the Champaign City Council, U of I researchers' project to link sensors, phones. A University of Illinois research team is looking to increase safety by equipping some city public spaces with motion, vibration, and acoustic sensors that communicate with smartphones. The team is headed by Kara Narstedt, a U of I computer science professor, who is applying for a National Science Foundation $5 million grant to be used over the course of 5 years. The application deadline is February 16th, and the decision will come 6 months after that. Narstedt met with Champaign City Council members on Tuesday and got their unanimous endorsement of the project, which includes a letter of support in the grant application. If the grant is received, the research team will collaborate with the city, Champaign MTD, Champaign Unit 4 schools, and some nonprofit organizations. The project focuses our privacy-preserving physical, digital, and sociological safety for underserved schools, libraries, recreation centers, and the bus stops that accompany them. Narstedt said the work will apply to community concerns about poor lighting, uneven sidewalks, low visibility at street corners or bus stops, and low understanding of digital privacy and security. As an example of the project's goals, Narstedt described how a smart bus station would work. She said presence detection sensors will be planted on bus stop shelters, in addition to the sidewalk and streetlights surrounding them. The shelters will be Wi-Fi access points, and both bus drivers and riders will receive phone alerts about where the bus is and how many riders to expect. A smart sidewalk will detect the presence of people and send that information to the bus driver, Narstedt said. We also want to detect if there's more than one person. MTD said a concern is a stop with a lot of kids who could push each other and suddenly jump into the street. Narstedt suggested to the council that if funded, the technology be implemented in the Bristol Place and Douglas Park neighborhoods. Council members had just voted Tuesday to put the final approval on the Bristol Place redevelopment master plan, and Narstedt said it would be cost-effective to work in Bristol as it's being rebuilt from the ground up. She also stressed the importance of consistent collaboration with the chosen neighborhood's residents, so the work's results will properly benefit them. Both council members and city residents mentioned some of the downfalls that can result from extended surveillance technology and the possibilities for the technology to be damaged. Still, council members said they liked the idea and noted how the city wasn't required to continue being involved after the 5 years expires. We have a teacher of the week. Variety's her favorite spice. Meet Jackson Gooch, a family and consumer science teacher at Champaign Centennial High School. As a family and consumer science educator, she's certified to teach nutrition and cooking, architecture and design, human development, fashion, and financial literacy. I have content knowledge in some pretty vast areas, she said, when asked what makes her unique as an educator. Here are her questions. What do your students like most about you? I think my students like that I am relatable. I am a new teacher, and I do my best to remember my time as a high school student and be there to support the needs of all my students. Three items you have on your desk. There's almost always some sort of cooking utensil, papers to file and grade, and snacks, because a hungry student cannot focus until they get some calories. Funniest question a student has ever asked you? Why won't my stove work? The last week of the semester, a student could not comprehend why her stovetop burners would not turn on. She was expecting to see flames, but it was an electric stove. I couldn't help but laugh at that one. Tell me about a lesson plan you're most proud of. The large meal that my students make at the end of the nutrition unit. Students work as teams to create a side dish for a large meal that we enjoy as a class. It is a wrap-up to all of the knowledge gained during the unit, and we invite the faculty and staff into the classroom to enjoy it with us. What's your classroom pet peeve? Cell phones. Trying to instill future career skills in my students means I am constantly reminding them that cell phones cannot be permanently glued to your hand when you have a real job. If I weren't a teacher, I would be a welder. In news from the Champaign County Circuit Court, another defendant pleads guilty in campus beating. A 20-year-old Champaign man who admitted taking part in kicking a man to unconsciousness in campus town about 4 months ago will be sentenced next month. Jeffrey Alexander Jordan, who listed an address in the 1700 block of Bloomington Road, pleaded guilty Tuesday to a single count of aggravated battery, admitting that on September 25th, he kicked Edwin McCraney about the head and body while McCraney was in the 300 block of East Green Street, Champaign. Alexander Jordan faces penalties ranging from probation to 2 to 5 years in prison when Judge Roger Weber sentences him on March 17. Assistant State's Attorney Scott Larson said McCraney, 22, of Champaign, had gotten into an argument with some people at a party at a nearby apartment. The disagreement spilled out into the parking lot and the sidewalk in that block and escalated to a savage beating. McCraney was knocked to the ground and kicked and stomped by at least 9 men that Champaign police were able to identify from surveillance video from nearby buildings. Authorities believe McCraney's beating prompted Robbie Patton, 19, of Champaign, to begin shooting at the kickers. None of them was struck, but 4 other bystanders who were not part of the party or argument were hit by gunfire. One was killed. Patton is awaiting trial on charges of murder and aggravated battery with a firearm. Of the 9 charged with McCraney's beating, 2 remain at large. One is in jail awaiting trial, and 6 others have pleaded guilty. 5 of the 6 who pleaded have been handed sentences ranging from 30 months to 5 years in prison. Larson agreed to dismiss, after sentencing, another residential burglary and theft case against Alexander Jordan, in which he is alleged to have entered a home on West Eureka Street in Champaign on August 29th. Alexander Jordan also has another pending weapons case in Peoria that will be resolved after his sentencing in this case. From Ford County, cause of death that followed fight to be disclosed at inquest. The cause of death has been determined for a suburban Chicago man who died at a Ford County hospital following a fight outside a Buckley bar, but the county's coroner is not releasing his findings until an inquest is held next week. Doug Wallace said that the inquest for Daniel K. Connolly, 25, of Lyons, will be held at 7 p.m. on February 15th in Paxton. During the inquest, Wallace said, a jury will hear evidence before being asked to decide whether the manner of death was natural, accidental, suicide, homicide, or undetermined. Wallace said his own determination on the cause of death will be revealed during the inquest. During the autopsy, there was no apparent sign of trauma at all found on Mr. McConley's body, Wallace said, adding that blunt force trauma has been ruled out. Meanwhile, Wallace said toxicology and histology results showed Mr. Connolly tested positive for alcohol and drugs of abuse. Wallace, however, declined to disclose what drugs were found. Witnesses to the Christmas night fight outside the Dutchmaster Bar, 114 South Railroad Avenue, told police that Mr. Connolly was an aggressor in the fight. Iroquois County Sheriff Derek Hagan said the fight appears to have been between Mr. Connolly and only one other man, Shane Weber, 24, of rural Loda, although Hagan said there were several other people present who tried to break it up. From the Thomasboro Village Board, building permit price surge advances. The Thomasboro Village Board has taken a step toward raising the cost of building permits by a bundle. Trustees unanimously agreed to have an ordinance drafted that would increase the fee from $10 to $200 for a new home and $250 for a new commercial building. It's been a long time since the city changed the fees, Mayor Brad Morris said. This will bring us more in line with other same-size villages. Trustee Mickey Wilson said feedback has leaned toward a flat rate rather than a more complex fee structure. And from Gifford, Lenny's closing briefly to add grill. Mary Sutherland, co-owner of Lenny's Ice Cream Gallery, spoke to the Gifford Village Board about changes possibly coming to the Main Street business. Sutherland said Lenny's would be closed from the end of February to the end of April or beginning of May. She also said a grill will be installed to serve burgers and fries. She's interested in serving beer and wine there as well, but it wouldn't cut into the business of other local bars and restaurants. We will not be open late, Sutherland said. Board members said they would look into what licenses are available. We're coming to the end of our first half hour. Take a short break then, and then I'll be returning with the second half hour of the News Gazette for Wednesday, the 8th of February. Please stay tuned.